From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In a survey a few years ago, New Hampshire teens were asked whether, over the past year, they'd considered suicide. Almost 14%, or 1 in 7, said yes, they had. And while considering doesn't mean actually doing, suicide is the second leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 24 after accidents. Now, though, several New Hampshire high schools, including in Exeter, Ware, and most recently Londonderry, say they're not going to wait for the next tragedy. These districts and others have proactively beefed up suicide education and prevention curricula. While many high school health classes include a suicide component, these new programs are going farther, attempting to give kids and adults in the schools a better roadmap of what to look for, and most importantly, how to intervene before a suicide happens. Today in The Exchange, schools tackle suicide. What's new about these efforts and the questions that inevitably come up, especially this one? Can there be too much conversation and information about suicide to the point where it might encourage a depressed or desperate teen to take their own lives? We'll talk about that and much more this hour, and let's hear from you too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour with us in studio, Elaine DeMello, co-chair of the Youth Suicide Prevention Assembly, and also a staff member at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, New Hampshire chapter. Elaine, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Laura. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Tara Holmes Ball. She's an advocate of bringing prevention programs to schools, including at the schools in Exeter. Her son, Connor, took his own life at age 14 in 2011. And Tara, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it, especially given what happened to you. I'm so sorry. And we'll get through this interview. Thank you very much for being here. I did want to turn to you first, Elaine. What about that question, the fear that if you talk too much about suicide, kids will get the wrong idea? What do you think?
There's been a lot of work that's been done in suicide prevention, particularly youth suicide prevention in New Hampshire for going on 20 years now. And much of that has been replicated across the United States. And what we've learned is that it is a topic we need to talk about, but we need to talk about it safely.
The right way.
Correct. So when we're broaching the subject of youth suicide, we want to talk about warning signs, we want to talk about resources, and we want to really emphasize the fact that people can get help and do get through this. Most people who attempt suicide do not go on to die by suicide. So much of these terrible tragedies can be prevented if we know what we're looking for. One thing that's important, though, is with youth suicide prevention programs, it's easy to jump on board and say, okay, let's just train the kids and tell them what to do and what to look for. But we've got to train the adults first. We've got to create that safety net, because if we teach kids to turn to adults and the adults are unprepared, it's kind of like putting out a 911 number and then forgetting to train the people who answer the call. So let's make sure all of the adults understand youth suicide, understand warning signs, are prepared, and also know where to turn to each other, where to get help, and what the next step is to get someone to the right resource.
Wow. So, and from what I've read, Elaine, some of these newer programs say train the adults, you know, from the janitor up to the principal, everybody.
Absolutely. We have, you mentioned Exeter, the SOS program is doing a great job of training the youth there. And prior to that program coming in, we had students and adults all training together. And the students there were training not only their peers, but they were training people in the cafeteria. And the staff in the cafeteria were very appreciative because they said, we hear stuff all the time, but we don't know what to do with it.
Well, and sometimes, you know, a certain adult will connect with a young person. It doesn't necessarily need to
Absolutely.
Be a teacher. It could be the person
Absolutely.
In the cafeteria or the secretary in the office. How do you approach this question, Tara, of, you know, the fear that if you talk too much about this, kids do get the wrong idea? What do you think?
I think that you have to talk about it. I think that by talking about it, you reduce stigma, and it makes kids feel like if they're struggling that it's okay. If they have a broken arm, they have a cast on it. So if there's something that they're struggling with with regards to their mental health, they should be able to talk about it and get the help that they need.
Do you think kids don't talk about it like they would about, hey, look, I broke my arm and, you know, football practice or whatever, because people who are struggling emotionally, mentally are seen as weird, crazy?
Well, I think there's that stigma. that goes along with mental health. And, you know, it's okay to talk about some things and not others. But, you know, some things need to be talked about, and depression and your mental health and how you feel. And if you're having thoughts of suicide, you need to talk to someone, a trusted adult, your friends, and not keep it inside.
Yeah. And sometimes that trusted adult may not be mom or dad.
Absolutely. The people at school, they, you know, from the cafeteria workers to the teachers to the bus drivers and to the students, they spend almost as much time every day with our children that we spend with them. So they're in a unique position to see something that their parents might not see and to point it out.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting because one of the youth who was training in the Exeter school said to the cafeteria staff, we don't have our filters on when we walk through that lunch line. So we would say some things in front of you that we might not say in front of our teacher or our guidance counselor. So, in fact, it's some of those people you least expect who are much more likely to hear some things and observe things in youth that others might not.
A couple more questions for you on just how we talk about this. And then I definitely want to ask you about some of the programs that are going on, how high schools are tackling this, your efforts, Tara, to make these programs required statewide through legislation. We'll definitely talk about that. But a couple Facebook comments came in before the show, and I want to invite everybody. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter, email exchange at nhpr.org, the number 1-800-892-6477. So here's a Facebook comment from Will. He says, making sure you don't shame or harass kids who admit to dark thoughts. Most people have at least thought about suicide by the time they're adults, though most never seriously considered it. Will says that position needs to be acknowledged and understood, treating every kid who admits to depression or self-harm as if they need to be on suicide watch polarizes teenagers about seeking help from adults. They need room to admit they're troubled without worrying that they'll be infantilized all over again by adults' overreactions. Don't hesitate to call them out on bull, but give them credit for being self-conscious. That's where half their problems start anyway. Real thoughtful comment from Will. Thank you very much. What do you think, Tara?
I think that the way kids feel, it's another component of who they are. And absolutely, they have to feel safe, that they can talk about their feelings and not be shamed and know that it's okay.
I do wonder. I think he makes a good point that, and I'll ask you this, Elaine, you know, if a kid comes forward, given all the concern these days about suicide and youth suicide, a concern that, you know, if I come forward with these thoughts, my parents and everybody are going to jump all over me.
So that's why training for adults is really key prior to training the youth, because we want the adults, whoever they are, the bus driver, the parent, the librarian at the local library, to be able to respond with a calm and a compassionate and caring approach. But also, youth go to adults because they trust that, number one, you're going to listen to me non-judgmentally, and number two, you're going to do something and take the right action. So those are the things we need to prepare the adults. And there's been studies that show that that's what youth look for when they turn to adults. So if it's the right approach and the right response, I think we create a very large safety net that increases the likelihood youth will come forward to get help.
Well, thanks for the Facebook comment. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Tough topic today in the exchange. We're talking about efforts in New Hampshire high schools to prevent teen suicide. You can join us with your comments, thoughts, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook like Will did. And Elaine and Tara, let's go to the phones. Tracy's calling from Laconia. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to jump in a little bit. I get to work with Elaine on a pretty regular basis, and I'm speaking from the public health perspective. I work at the Lakes Region Partnership for Public Health, and we are one of three public health networks in the state who are lucky enough to be partnering with NAMI New Hampshire on a suicide prevention grant. So I wanted to, the conversation you're having around schools being trained and engaged in prevention is definitely an important piece of the puzzle. But I wanted to sort of just bring up the point that the idea is really to take it as to approach it with a public health perspective in mind, meaning to engage multiple sectors. So it's knowing that suicide is a very complex issue, and preventing suicide really takes this coordinated effort among multiple sectors. So it's really...
Tracy, can you give us a concrete example of what you're talking about on the ground? Are you working in a high school in Laconia?
So we work with multiple schools in the region, high schools. A concrete example would be, for example, it's called the Connect Training. That engages people, community members, in understanding the warning signs, how to respond, next step for resources, the exact same training that's happening for school personnel. Like you said, everybody from the janitor to the principal is something that we are working to bring to police officers, for other first responders, faith leaders, family, friends, mental health providers, neighbors, you know, as many folks as we can in the community to help understand the warning signs and to know how to respond and to know who to point, you know, to point them to for resources.
And I hate to ask it this way, but have you seen this in action? I mean, have you been able to steer somebody from a terrible path?
We have, you know, and it's, you know, I think it's always hard to measure prevention. That's always the
right.
challenge.
But sure.
We have, for example, someone in our office. She's a community health educator, meaning that she is based out of our office, but she works in the schools to focus on health and wellness and obesity prevention. And she does a number of different things in the schools. And she was one of the folks that we were trained in this Connect model, and I know that Elaine can speak more about the Connect model, which is very important in this whole process. But she was trained, which essentially gives you the warning signs, how to respond, and then who to point them to for help.
And so she was able to perhaps prevent a young person from taking his or her own life.
She was doing her normal work with students around, you know, a different health and wellness topic. And she sort of noticed, literally, it was like a couple days after this Connect training. It was all fresh in her mind. And she noticed these warning signs, like, by the book. And she was, you know, as opposed to just brushing it off, which I think a lot of people do and say, well, they're teenagers, maybe they're moody. I mean, I don't know. You know, we don't want to intervene and make it a big deal. She actually took action, connected her to resources, and a whole wraparound team sort of swooped in and really saved the day, I think.
Tracy,
I
have to let you go. Thank you so much for calling in, and we'll follow up on what you said in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what New Hampshire high schools are doing to attack youth suicide. It's a tough topic we're tackling at this hour. We hope to hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And following up on what we heard from that last person who called in, talking about some of the prevention efforts at the high school in the Lakes region at Laconia. And she mentioned that, you know, there was a case where someone was able to intervene, get a young person what they needed. It was great to hear that story. Something that I did want to pick up on, though, with both of you. You first, Tara Holmes-Ball, please. She said it's hard to know sometimes when to jump in because teenagers are, by nature, moody. And they seem weird and they seem depressed and it's hard to know, are they just tired or are they really in trouble? I just wonder how you sort that out.
It's true. You have to know the signs and I guess know the child. And if something isn't normal, just out of the ordinary, more moodier than normal, you know, the signs of, if you are aware of what the signs are, you can step in.
Yeah. So tell us more signs that you're aware of and that, you know, moody is one thing, but moody times 10 is another thing. Because, again, as the mom of a teen and a preteen, they get pretty moody sometimes. It's hard to know.
Well, they do. And, you know, there's the outright I'm going to kill myself comment. You know, it sometimes they may seem flip. It may just seem like something that a child's throwing out there, but you must take it seriously. You know, other signs, giving away their personal items, you know, withdrawing from their family and friends, just a total different set of behaviors than you're used to.
Yeah. Wow. Giving away your personal items. That's a biggie.
That Absolutely.
Would be, that would be a big warning sign. Go ahead, Elaine. It's hard to sort out the normal, you know, what's
really
normal,
is
weird, moody teenage behavior from suicidal behavior.
Correct. Parents, especially who know their kids, often see a change. And it doesn't mean that the change clearly shows depression, but something's not quite right. So it's important to pay attention to anything that concerns you. And err on the side of caution. Even if you don't know the youth that well, check in with them and talk with them. See how it's going with them. Ask them if everything's okay. And then don't drop that ball. Take it and say, well, let's go talk to somebody else who might see what's going on. So it could be a variety of things that we see. But keep in mind, kids can be pretty quiet and non-responsive verbally, but they put a lot up on social media. So check that source as well. If you're concerned about a youth and you're the parent or the friend of that teen, check and see what they're saying on Facebook. It might be a lot more than what they're saying to you personally.
Yeah, you know, I've heard other people say that. That's really interesting. It's such a weird phenomenon, isn't it, that you wouldn't talk to a friend, but you put it up on Facebook, right. So, you know, 600 people can see it.
Fortunately, that's at least an option to find out if somebody may be at risk and respond.
Joining us now on the phone is someone who has been putting in a new suicide prevention program at John Stark Regional High School. Tammy Zielinski is with us on the phone. She's a psychologist at John Stark. And Tammy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What push was there at John Stark to put this new program in place? Was there something terrible that happened, or was it a desire to prevent a tragedy?
It's a desire to prevent. We'd rather put all of our efforts in preventing than the intervention and postvention. I think any time a student expresses suicidal ideation, that number's too high, and students do. And like you were saying before, it's clearly evident on social media. Teenagers text one another, Snapchat, instant message one another. So this program actually targets the peers to help their friends who are displaying any kind of warning signs of suicide.
You know, it's interesting. Elaine talked earlier about, yes, definitely help the peers understand what to do, but the adults also need training. Otherwise, when the kids turn to the adults and the adults don't know what to do, it's not that helpful. What do you think?
Right. Absolutely. We also got this information out to teachers, staff, administrators. There was some information on our website for parents. We've had a real wonderful support from our school to get this program up and running.
And give us a little bit more on the program. It's called SOS. What does it stand for,
sure,
Tammy? And what makes it different?
Yeah, it's called the Signs of Suicide Prevention Program, and it's sponsored by the Screening for Mental Health. And what it does is it's comprised of a video with different vignettes where peers are talking to peers, and clearly one of them is showing signs of suicidal ideation. And they show what to do and what not to do, and they go through that process of getting their friend help. We have a discussion following that video. The next piece is that every student gets a card, and the program urges students to act, and it's also an acronym for Acknowledge, Care, and Tell. Acknowledge by listening to your friend and not ignoring them. Care by letting your friend know that you care, and telling a trusted adult that you are worried about your friend.
I was just going to say, I'm very interested in this video, what to do and what not to do. So what should you not do if a friend comes and says, I'm having suicidal thoughts?
The overarching message is not to keep it a secret. Very often peers feel like they're breaking trust of their friend.
Sure, I can totally see that. Right.
Yeah, they're often conflicted by that, and what should I do, what should I not do, and their instinct might be to keep a secret, because that's what we've told them when they're younger, that you should keep those kinds of secrets. But when it comes to suicide, absolutely, in no way, shape, or form should you keep a secret. You need to tell an adult. So that's basically what the message is. You need to tell someone, and you also need to tell your friend that you need to tell someone. And it's better to maybe have a friend who's upset with you for a little bit than not to have a friend at all.
Mm. What sorts of feedback have you gotten from parents about this? I wonder if some of them had questions, concerns.
No, overall, the feedback's been pretty positive. We have two wonderful health teachers here who cover this in their health class, and we piggyback this program on what teachers were already doing in health classes. Parents were made aware that this program was going to happen. And students, if they were particularly sensitive to the subject, that had the option to not participate. But overall, the feedback's been very positive.
Did anybody decide not to participate?
Just a couple of kiddos, and that's typical. You know, but they're able to get the information in another way or at another time. We're also going to continue to run this program in health classes because health is a required class. So within a few years, every student should have had exposure to this program.
So were the parents of those kids who opted out, were they concerned that their kids were kind of on the edge and they didn't want them to get the information or what? I'm just curious about that.
I mean, some students have some past trauma or either maybe have lost a friend to suicide or a family member, and it's particularly a sensitive topic. So they'll get materials in another way, and maybe just being a part of the discussion is a bit too hard for them. So you do want to give students the option to maybe receive this information in another way. It's a difficult topic to discuss,
absolutely,
but it's certainly an important one.
And Tammy, last question for you, please. At what age do students get this suicide prevention information?
And with this particular program, this is the first semester we piloted here, and we went into health classes. Most students in health class are ninth grade. There's some 10th graders, maybe some juniors as well, but the majority will be receiving it as freshmen.
Okay. Tammy, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Tammy Zielinski, psychologist at John Stark Regional High School, which, as we heard, has a new suicide prevention program called SOS. We want your comments, questions, and thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Elaine and Tara, let's go right back to our listeners. And George is calling from Whitefield. Hi, George. You're on the air. Oh, George, I hope you call back. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is welcome. I have a couple Facebook comments that I want to share with you in just a moment. But Tara, to you first, again, given what you have been through yourself with your son, how do you feel about these programs that are now coming into schools like John Stark?
I think they're fantastic. I think the Signs of Suicide program, it's a universal, evidence-based best practice, and it touches every student in the school. So when you combine that with the adults who are trained to recognize the signs of suicide, you're creating the safety net for kids. And they use the program at the Cooperative Middle School in Stratham for the eighth grade. And last year, around Christmas time, these eighth graders were now freshmen. They had gone through the program. One of their friends presented with signs of suicide, and they knew what to do. They acknowledged, cared, they told a trusted adult.
They did tell,
they
even
did.
Though there's this taboo against
Absolutely.
Telling.
Absolutely, because, you know, it hits home for them. It happened in their neighborhood. It happened to their friend's brother, and they told a trusted adult. This boy had a plan. You know, a week before Christmas, and he received the help that he needed, and he's here with us now. So, you know, a program like this absolutely works. It gives the kids the tools they need, and it saves lives.
So, eighth grade.
Well, they were in eighth grade,
yes,
when they received it at the Cooperative Middle School, but when they were freshmen, it was with them. They knew what to do.
Yeah, even though it was not available to freshmen at that high school.
Correct.
Yeah. Why do you suppose that is? Given that it's at the middle school, why wouldn't it be at the high school?
I'm not sure. We'd love to have an evidence-based universal program at Exeter High School. They've got the Connect program, which is great, and they have the student trainers, and the staff, as Elaine mentioned, has been trained, and you know, the community at large also went through the Connect program. So I don't have an answer for that question.
Yeah, and I know you've been working on getting legislation, putting this in schools. Did you want to also follow up on what we heard, Elaine, from Tammy Zielinski at John Stark?
In terms of training the youth, once again, I think there's a whole environment that youth perceive about help seeking. And if we can create that warm and compassionate kind of environment that says, whoever you turn to, we're going to be here for you, and we're going to try to do the right thing and make sure you get some help, is one of those things you can't put your finger on, but it says to youth in a school or in a community, you can get help, and we're here for you, and we're going to make sure you stay safe.
We're talking a lot about, you know, supports and finding a trusted adult. From my understanding, though, too, there's other components that sometimes come up with suicide. Correct me if I'm wrong. Bullying, substance abuse. Do these programs address those issues, Elaine? It isn't just having a trusted adult, right? Sometimes it's a bunch of other factors.
Right. We see suicide at the endpoint of a continuum of risk factors. So I can speak to the CONNECT program, which looks at all of the kinds of things that might contribute to suicide risk. So yes, it would identify when someone's in trouble early on, and not just at that crisis point, so that you were not waiting until things are absolutely in a serious situation, but trying to detect and create an environment early on that kids know if they're in trouble or a friend's in trouble, they can go and get some help.
Let's take another call. This is Becky in Chester. Hi, Becky. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. My question was actually something you just talked about instead of waiting until it becomes the crisis of a suicide prevention, how can we shift our resources toward the earlier symptoms of depression? And what are the real risk factors for depression in kids? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Becky. I want to turn to both of you on that. Do you want to jump in first on that, Tara, or risk factors? We'll give that to Elaine first. Okay, go ahead.
So I think that's an excellent question because there are many things that can happen early in a child's life that can increase their risk for suicide. Some of them aren't even suicide related, perhaps, like you mentioned, bullying, lack of support, mental health problems that are emerging. So any ways that we can educate youth, educate parents, educate schools and communities about some of these things, we can manage that early on and reduce that risk. There's also something called protective factors, and that's, again, putting in supports, eyes on, connections with others. There's even a protective factor where if parents eat dinner together regularly with their kids, it actually reduces the risk of dropout, of teen pregnancy, of, you know, substance use and suicide. It just reduces that risk. And that's a simple thing that families can do that may make a big difference in the outcome for their youth.
It's not about the food, is it? It's about checking
well,
in.
Well, I can tell you, I was at a restaurant once and I sat next to a family of four, and the parents and their kids, who were like 10 and 12, ordered dinner. This was in another state. And as soon as the waitress walked away, they all pulled out like a cell phone or some kind of a electronic device. And there was nothing, no words exchanged for the rest of that meal. Now, I don't know if that counts as a family dinner. Maybe they were texting each other. But I would say that that I think we need to
texting
have.
Each other across the table.
Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know if that counts as that.
But I do think that connectedness with others that youth feel does increase the likelihood that they're going to seek help and reduce their risk.
Well, and here's a Facebook comment from Steve, also talking about risk factors. He says, alter the school environment, which can be brutal, and actively discourage bullying, which seems to account for a majority of suicides. Just given your work, Tara, on this issue and given your own experience, how much do you think bullying is really a part of this?
It's often blamed, but I don't know. It is often blamed, but it's not the reason that a child decides to take their life. It's another factor. I think that it makes them feel vulnerable. It makes them feel bad about themselves. And if you take that out, you're taking another component that might contribute to suicide out of the picture.
So there's a number of factors. That's one of them. But that's often pinpointed as the factor.
It is.
You would say no.
I would say no, Elaine.
Suicide is a complex issue. So we don't want to say bullying causes suicide just like we want to say any other one thing. We really need to look at a whole array of things. And certainly, as Tara says, reducing that and taking that out of the element can make a big difference. But we, again, know that it's a very complex issue. I also want to say that schools get put on the hook for handling issues around bullying and suicide and substance use. These are community issues, and schools take a great stand in leadership in working on them. But we should all be working on them. We can work on them with mental health, law enforcement, social services, after-school programs, parents especially. Any number of sectors of the community can play a big role in helping with these issues.
Let's take another call. This is Suzanne in Concord. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I have lost two sisters and a niece suicidally, and they were all in their adolescent years. And there's just two things I am concerned about. And one is the capability of adolescents to go to rush judgment. In other words, suicide is generally described as something with symptoms over a short or medium period of time. And yet we still find children making snap judgments and and taking their lives. The question that's important to me more than that, though, is are pediatricians trained, and do they rely heavily on the DSM-4?
DSM-4 is, Suzanne, I mean, I know what it is, but yeah, go ahead.
The Diagnostic Statistical Manual.
Sure.
For mental health. I'm basically concerned that our pediatricians are not trained well enough, either in suicide prevention or also in the role that nutrition plays, because I firmly believe that when we cut fats out of the diet, we are damaging the brain.
Well, Suzanne, thank you for calling in, and I'm very sorry to hear about your losses. That is a huge, huge, huge burden. Perhaps after a short break, both of you will talk about her very good point. You know, adolescents do rush to judgment, and we know a lot now about the adolescent brain, how it really, the areas of the brain that control impulsivity are not well formed until our early 20s. So we'll talk about that after a short break. Thank you, Suzanne, for your call. The number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll follow up in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the tough topic of schools in New Hampshire tackling suicide. As we're hearing, almost 14% of New Hampshire teens surveyed recently said they'd considered taking their own lives. So educators are increasingly focused on this issue with some new approaches that we're hearing about that do seem to be having some success. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tara, just before the break, we were talking with Suzanne, who, my goodness, lost two sisters and a niece to suicide, all at that teenage age. And she mentioned something that's a really good point. Adolescents rush to judgment. Their brains aren't developed to, you know, for self-control. They just make these stupid decisions. And later you ask them and you say, why did you do that? And they say, I don't know. It was a bad decision. But at the time, those decision-making mechanisms just aren't kicking in. What do you think about that? It's so hard to talk about preventing suicide when the brain just isn't working well, if you could put it that way.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think there's an element of that in the loss of my son with the impulsivity. And that's the way their brains are wired until they're 24 years old. You know, that's why death by suicide is the second leading cause of death for 10 to 24 year olds in our state. And I should point out that it's third nationally. So this is something that we really need to address here.
Yeah. So what do you do about that, Elaine? Impulsivity? I mean, the brain isn't firing the way it would in an adult. How do you address that? I think Suzanne makes a great point.
Yeah, it is a good point. And sorry about her losses. Especially with young people, they are by nature impulsive. Even when they're doing well, sometimes they don't think about what they're doing, or they get into a crisis situation and don't have the coping skills or the history in life to say, okay, tomorrow will be a new day.
That's right, a better day.
Sometimes that perfect storm happens where a youth is in crisis, they don't see their way out, there isn't somebody readily available, and sometimes lethal means is available. So one very important and effective best practice that parents and others can take is if you're concerned about somebody in the moment, stay with them, do not leave them alone, ask them directly about suicide, try to get them in touch with someone, and keep them away from anything that might harm themselves.
Well, and young men especially are likely to use guns to kill themselves.
Correct. And there is a lot of firearms available in New Hampshire, in the homes in New Hampshire. And that's not necessarily a bad thing in and of itself, unless it's in the same house with someone who may be at risk for suicide. Just like if someone were drinking, we wouldn't want them to have the keys to the car. It's an important time to keep the firearm away from that person, ideally out of the house, so that it's not a temptation when they are in that crisis stage. What we know about suicidal crisis is that it often passes. It doesn't last forever. And so for many people, hours later or days later, they're in a much better place and they're thankful that nothing happened.
Joining us now on the phone is someone who has, again, personal experience with this issue and has been involved with high schoolers in the Upper Valley. Michael Whitman's on the phone. He's long been involved in a wide variety of local, statewide, and national suicide prevention efforts since he lost his 23-year-old son, Breck, to suicide 20 years ago. And, Michael, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Good morning, Elaine. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've long been involved, Michael, with the Hanover High School Suicide Awareness Committee. Who leads this group, Michael? What does it do?
Well, this is a 10-year-old group that was started by a local pediatrician who was concerned about the amount of suicide ideation that she had heard about. And the Hanover High School Suicide Awareness Committee is comprised of administrators, health teachers, school nurse, counselors, and students, as well as some members of the public.
Wow. So what do they do? How do they try to help?
Well, each year they work on student-conceived projects of outreach and education for their peers, the students. And some of them are very creative that have helped really raise awareness. They develop protocols for staff, including coaches, teachers, and supportive staff, as someone else mentioned, about how to recognize some of the warning systems and to know about the resources that are available. They designed and presented a full school assembly on suicide awareness that, again, the students put together.
Wow, they did a whole school assembly on this.
Yes, it was very well received. Often in a large group like that, there'll be a lot of noise and fooling around. But for this assembly, you could have heard a pin drop for the entire period.
Wow. You know, Michael, you've also worked on what's called postvention. What is that, and how does Hanover High approach this?
Well, postvention is taking care of the people who have been affected by suicide, such as a support group for suicide loss survivors. The high school does not have a support group, but it helps make people aware, both parents and students, that there is an Upper Valley Survivors of Suicide Loss Support Group. And there are some, interestingly, there are some very good online resources for support. For people to talk about the issues that they experience after a close suicide loss, it can be very hard to find people among your regular friends and associates who are comfortable to talk about it. So it helps to have a combination of friends and experienced people to talk about some of the issues and get them off your chest.
And we started out, Michael, talking about the concern some people have about talking about it, that if you discuss suicide too much or in the wrong way, as Elaine mentioned, it actually might give kids the wrong idea, to use a worn-out phrase. There is this phenomenon, Michael, a suicide cluster that we hear about with young people. I wonder what you think about that and how you folks in the Hanover area are approaching that.
Well, that is something that is recognized by mental health professionals who work particularly in the area of suicide, that there can be, particularly, I think, among adolescents, a temptation to imitate what someone else has done because they see, oh, this person was in pain and they got out of pain. And by talking about what has happened and how it is an extraordinary phenomenon and a non-normal response to pressures and stresses that kids feel, we can help reduce the incidence of imitative or cluster suicide.
You know, Michael, last question for you, please. Your son, as you've told us before on this show, was a young adult when he took his life. And again, our heart still goes out to you, obviously, even though it's been a long time.
Thank you.
What do you think, Michael? Do colleges need these programs too? I mean, I've read that while suicide rates may be down for the younger teens, they're not down for older teens and young adults, that 18 to 24-year-old group. So, you know, what does that suggest to you, Michael?
Well, it suggests that suicide is still a factor in college, and many colleges have programs such as have been described this morning as being as going on in high schools. They are doing this in college because it is a huge concern to college administrators. The best way to find out about this is online, finding out what's being done at various colleges and getting ideas for administrators at colleges, perhaps where things are not yet being done. You can find out much of this online, and there are some very good collegiate-level programs.
Okay. Michael, thanks as always. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Laura.
That's Michael Whitman. Again, he's long been involved in suicide prevention, including at Hanover High School, as we heard. Michael lost his 23-year-old son, Breck, to suicide 20 years ago. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And here's a Facebook comment that came in from Anne Marie. She says, parents in general know their children best. Help equip parents with information so they know what to look for. Anne Marie says, watch what is assigned to students via reading assignments that carry a dark theme. Teachers never know what students are going through in their personal life, and adding disturbing reading assignments with a dark theme could add to their depression, etc. Anne-Marie says, assign uplifting materials. It helps all students. This gets back again to the idea of the messaging and how you talk about it and how you don't. Anne-Marie, thanks for the Facebook comment. What do you think, Tara?
I think if teachers and educators are aware of those students who might be at risk, that they can address that. And I know that in my own case with my son, who is at the high school in Exeter now, his teachers are aware of things that might be troubling to him, and he is allowed to participate in conversations or read books, or you know. They make sure that he knows what to expect because he's particularly sensitive to the subject.
Right. And how is he doing? How old is he, Tara, if you don't mind sharing that information?
He's 15, yeah. And he's doing well. He misses his brother every day,
right.
Just like we all do. And he's a remarkably resilient boy. He's compassionate and empathetic, and he's doing as well as we could hope.
Right. And it sounds like the school, again, is aware, as Anne-Marie points out, of what is going on in this young man's life and is kind of adapting
and to
that.
It's not just with him. It's with other children as well. You know, they're walking through the hall. They don't make a big deal out of it. They pull him in, give him a piece of candy, have a chat, you know, and send him on their way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here's an email that just came in from Lynette. Can you give us some concrete questions to open a concerned dialogue with teens suspected of suicide desires? Great question, Lynette. Why don't you take that one, Elaine?
So first I want to let people know that if you go online and you Google Mayo Clinic teen suicide, there's a fabulous video that's less than 4 minutes with teens talking directly to parents as if the parents were listening. Here's what I might look like. Here's what you say to me. Here's what you don't say to me.
Really? Wow.
It's excellent. And it's everything we want to teach parents in, you know, short order. But to sum it up, it would be to say to somebody in a caring way and a direct way, I'm worried about you. Are you thinking about taking your life? If the answer is no, you've obviously already gotten there because there's some concern. So continue to explore it and say, well, I've seen changes. I just want to let you know that I really care. Is there someone else you'd like to talk to? Because maybe that teen is at risk, but they don't want to talk to the person who's asking. Can I take you somewhere to another adult that might be able to help? Basically, we say don't drop the hot potato. You know that something's up. Make sure that youth knows that in a caring way, you're going to make sure that they stay safe. If the answer is yes, by all means, continue to gather information. They're probably the one who's going to want to tell you. You're probably the one they're going to want to express what's going on. And gather as much as you can. And then again, say to them, there's someone that I want to take you with to make sure that you're safe. And make sure that when you direct them to that professional who's going to evaluate them, and or the parent, of course, is involved, make sure you tell that person everything that youth has told you. Because sometimes by the time the youth gets to that next person, they don't share everything again. They're tired. They want to go home. It's not a big deal anymore.
They're tired of talking to
adults.
Right.
So make sure that person on the receiving end knows everything that you're concerned about.
Let's take another call. And thank you for that email. Lynette to Concord. Mo is on the air. Hi, Mo. Go ahead.
Over the years, I've worked a lot with LGBT youth. And I think a simple thing that people can say is just to be very careful what they say around young people and be positive. Parents should let their children hear them say I love you no matter what. It's a simple thing. It's amazing how this is still an issue in this day and age.
Yeah, Mo, can you talk a little bit more about that, LGBT youth, and sort of the special concerns surrounding suicide with this group of kids?
They really do worry that their parents will reject them, that their family will reject them. There's still an awful lot of bullying at school around it. Even in New Hampshire, it's pretty good on LGBT issues, but it's still really a difficult thing during adolescence. It's a tough time anyway. Put this on top of it, and kids are really vulnerable. And the suicide rate for LGBT kids is much higher than for their counterparts.
Okay. Mo, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it. And let's take another call. This is Deb Carr. Go ahead, Deb. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. And I just want to applaud what everybody is doing to address this. One of the things that I would like to mention and maybe ask about is the power of example that children could learn from an attempt survivor. Certainly keeping safe messaging at the forefront of the message, but is it possible and is it something that would be wise to address children to get that hope and that recovery from somebody that's been there?
Wow. Okay. Thank you very much for calling in, Deb. And either of you want to address that, Tara or Elaine? What do you think?
I'd be happy to comment. Deb is someone who runs a program at NAMI New Hampshire called In Our Own Voice, and it's people who have lived with mental illness, who have learned, who have gotten into recovery, who are doing just leading very successful lives and are able to tell their stories in a safe way. And I can't tell you how inspiring those stories are. Again, if they're shared safely, not focusing on an attempt or, you know, the dark days so much as here's how I got through and coped with some pretty significant mental health issues. We've had presentations by those folks. And by the way, anyone can contact NAMI New Hampshire and ask for a presentation at their school or campus or church or wherever. And we've had kids where they write an evaluation after the program and they will write things like, I will get help. Now I see that there is hope. And if we touch people in those ways, and these are kids who will go up to the teacher and say, I never thought I could get through something like this. I see other people can do it, and I know I can do it now too. And these are teachers who were really concerned about this particular kid. So I think those stories in and of themselves can be very powerful.
Well, and Tara, last question for you. I know you've been working with Representative Schlachman to try to get legislation passed that would make suicide prevention programs, like the ones we've talked about this hour, mandatory in New Hampshire schools. Just give us an update on that.
So we had a bill before the House last year, and there was no opposition in the committee, in the Education Committee, but unfortunately it did not pass. Just to require suicide education for educators and students in New Hampshire, it was, I think, in keeping with the New Hampshire way. It would give schools the choice of which program they might use, but just to make sure that the education was there and that there was a program in place. So we'll be back next year.
So next were session. There concerns about cost or the time out from other subject areas of study? Or
I think a misunderstanding about current Department of Education rules that suggest but don't require education. So,
okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here. I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
That's Tara Holmes Ball. Again, she's an advocate of bringing prevention programs to the schools, including in Exeter. Her son Connor took his own life in 2011, so she's talked about that as well. Elaine DeMello, thank you also for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Elaine DeMello, co-chair of the Youth Suicide Prevention Assembly and a staff member at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel with help from Melanie Plenda. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.